Space Oddity. Hello and welcome back to Space Oddity, the podcast of the Collaborative Research Center 1265, Refiguration of Spaces. My name is Zara, and today we will talk to one of our current guest researchers, Merav Kadar, about an article she co-authored called Dancing with Tears in Our Eyes,
which deals with the topics of alternative culture and urbanism in Israel and Palestine, specifically in the city of Jaffa. She will talk to us about her research done at an iconic bar, Analulu, and how the nightlife experienced at this place relates to the larger social and political landscape there, and how perhaps at this bar there was the birth of a new kind of hipster, the so-called political hipster.
Merav is a Minerva Foundation postdoc fellow at TU Berlin. She received her PhD from the Hebrew University for work on individuals' urban agency. She was a fellow at the joint interdisciplinary doctoral program Human Rights Under Pressure of Freie Universität Berlin and the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. She has worked in international projects dealing with urban development and the arts, and her work is published in distinguished journals such as Urban Studies and Journal of Urban Affairs. She is interested in spatial justice, urban art and culture, urban politics, and political theory of cities. Her current work focuses on art and culture in contested cities. Welcome to our podcast, Merav. We're very glad to have you here.
Thank you.
Did we forget anything in your introduction about yourself? Anything you want to share with us?
So the other author of this paper is Professor Daniel Monteresco. He's an associate professor of urban anthropology and food studies at the Department of Sociology and Social Anthropology at the Central European University in Vienna. Danny is a great friend and a colleague. He grew up in Jaffa, and he's a Jaffalog, as we call it, a real Jaffa expert. He researched and wrote about Jaffa extensively. I started researching Jaffa as part of my master research at UCL, and we met in a conference panel he organized on the city. As it sometimes happens to researchers, I fell in love with my research subject. And shortly after, I moved to Jaffa, where my friends and I started to hang out in this small little bar. There was something really special about this place, something I never experienced at the center of Israel before, or maybe even just before. I told Danny about all of this, and he came to see for himself. And only short 5 years later, we had an article.
Yeah, research takes time and is always a bit of a journey with an unknown destination, but we're glad that you arrived. Can you tell us briefly when, during which time you did the research for this article, and what were you trying to discover through this research, and you know, what motivated you to focus on this place, Analulu?
So what made the Analulu Bar so special for me, and I think generally, was the unique social diversity of the clientele, the people that came there, and the artistic and cultural program it offered. So it kind of had an alternative urban vision for Jaffa in particular, but for Israel in generally. Namely, this vision was of an all-encompassing, bi-national, queer, and tolerant urban reality. We have only a short session here, so I won't be able to dive into all the nuances of the Israeli society, but I should at least explain that the Israeli society is a rather segregated and conflicted one, as you probably know. The divides comes in different forms and sizes, so Mizrahi versus Ashkenazi, religious versus non-religious, center versus periphery, and so on. But the most present and most bleeding conflict and divide is by far the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. A quick clarification detour before we move back to the paper itself. I use in the podcast, and we used in the paper, the term Palestinians in a comprehensive manner, referring both to those who live within the 1948 borders and those who live in the Palestinian territories. Though the 1948 Palestinians are known by the Israeli authorities as Israeli Arabs, meaning they are Israeli citizens, I followed their self-identifications as Palestinians, and I would refer to them as such. So though the Analulu also hosted Palestinians from the West Bank occasionally, the paper usually refers to Palestinians or Israeli citizens by law. So back to the paper, ethnically mixed towns such as Jaffa represent the dialectic between intimacy and violence, which is the characteristic of binational urbanism in Israel and Palestine. The other cannot just be wished away from everyday life in the city. This challenges both the Zionist and Palestinian national imaginations, resulting in these cities representing the paradox Palestinian citizens face in the Jewish state. Now, at the same time, these urban realities also force spatial and social mix between the two segregated community, one which stresses the potential imagination of real joint living. For this reason, it is almost impossible to find intentional shared spaces, and especially the kind that allowed to envision different power relations, namely an equal or more equal one. The Analulu suggested this kind of envisioning, and in the shape of a party, nonetheless. Mm-hmm. So not only could you feel good and politically involved, but you could also have all of this while also having fun and meeting cool people. These themes were very appealing for me as a private person, but as an urban researcher, I could not escape the urban setting which allowed this, the existence of the Analulu, which we'll elaborate on shortly. All of this together set the grounds for our research. In a way, this research started already in 2012 when I first visited the Analulu and continued till 2019, where the bar sadly closed its doors indefinitely. The core of the fieldwork, in-depth interview and ethnographic observations was done during the bar's prime years, which is 2013 to 2016, and continued in lower capacities to 2019. And in some ways that we maybe discuss later, it continues till today.
I was wondering, compared to other cities in Israel, what makes Jaffa kind of special?
What makes Jaffa special is that it's the only Arab town in the center of Israel. So you do have Ramleh and Lod, which are a bit more central, but they are in the what we will call still the socio-economical periphery. Well, Jaffa is really at the center of Israel, so it's a prime location. It's 10 minutes from Tel Aviv, you know, and it has Arab citizens in it, which means that you cannot escape the exchange, you cannot escape the encounter, and this is the only place at the center of Israel when where you will have this. What happened in, well, I would even say since the 90s, but in full power in the last decade or two, was that people realized, and especially real estate agents realized, that this is a prime location on the seaside, which meant that now the city was not just, so it did not only have this oriental image of the place where you go and have hummus. That was what Jaffa was before. You go and have hummus in Jaffa. Maybe you'll go to the port for a second, but that's all. But then you would actually have very cheap real estate where you on the seaside. And that's what made the big difference. The only thing is that it always happens with gentrification, you also have the local population that is in the middle. But this time it's also Arabs that have where to be pushed out to. Mm-hmm. So while Jewish residents will be pushed out to neighboring cities, it's harder for the Arab residents to find, the locals to find people that will actually rent out houses for them, but also they won't have their infrastructure.
What is the relationship with Tel Aviv? Because it has some sort of dialogue with Berlin, right? It's kind of a liberal place. There are clubs. I think the techno scene is also quite big. So I was wondering, how's the relationship between the two cities?
So that's also interesting because Jaffa is in a way kind of the smaller and the younger sister of Tel Aviv nowadays. But really, Jaffa is an historical city and Tel Aviv is the young city that was just added to it from the north. And after the formation of the State of Israel, Jaffa was annexed to Tel Aviv. And now they're like one big city when Jaffa is a quarter of Tel Aviv, really. And it's an interesting dialectics between the two cities, because while Jaffa was left behind because of its Arab population, but also a lot of Jewish immigrants that were put there, so just settled there. Tel Aviv was really booming and is a very narrow liberal, but also very cosmopolitan, very liberal city. When Jaffa is still represents or represented a more conservative kind of landscape and more religious one. But nowadays, of course, it became also culturally very hip, and a lot of gentrified places that makes a whole different scene. And in comparison to different city, I think Jaffa is also considered now kind of the more lively, interesting, exotic spot of the city.
So would people basically move out to Jaffa because also Tel Aviv is kind of extremely expensive, or would that be something people would do, or it's rather still?
We're tapping into another paper of mine.
Okay.
But,
no,
but yes, you have a lot of gentrification in Jaffa, and you have all kinds of gentrifiers. Mm. Nowadays, it's really expensive already, so it will be as expensive at the center of Tel Aviv, and many times the infrastructure would be still less good. And yeah, there is some more violence and tension and so on. But yeah, you had people moving there for political reasons, wanting to have some kind of shared communities. You have people not moving there for political reasons, saying, no, this is an Arab space and should be left as an Arab space. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you have all kinds of gentrifiers, and I can refer you to my paper, Gentrifiers and Attitudes About Gentrification, that is about gentrifiers in Jaffa.
Can I ask, how does this gentrification look like? Because in Berlin, for instance, you have a lot of gentrifiers that like to move into like the Altbau, you know, this old buildings. So that's kind of like the ideal. But I know that in other places, the contrast is bigger because the old building gets just tore down and replaced with, you know, a shiny white kind of modern building. How is that over there?
So you have all kinds of gentrification, especially in the last decade. When people started moving to Jaffa, some people date that back to the 80s, really, the urban pioneers, as we call them. You can also trace it in the 90s or then in 2000. It depends where do you want to come from and where exactly in Jaffa, because it's such a small place. But the aesthetics of gentrification is something that you have over worldwide, and it's always also a bit localized. So on the one hand, you will have, okay, the shiny new buildings that people move in, which will usually be a bit of the later waves. But you will always have in the first waves and a bit after also the gentrifiers that kind of appreciate the local aesthetic of the buildings. So in Berlin, it will be Altbau. In Jaffa, it will be old Arab houses. Okay. But you will have both, of course. Mm-hmm. You have big developments, which are new and shiny, and you have very old derelict houses, but with some oriental charm and the arches and so on. No, very nice ones, nice floors.
Well, this all sounds super interesting, and there's so many aspects that we still want to address, but let's set the scene and travel acoustically to Israel first. Jaffa, Israel, 2015. More than 70 years after the Palestinian Nakba, the Jaffa Arabs helplessly watch as their city turns into a bourgeois space of Jewish consumption. Three decades of intensive urban redevelopment and neoliberal planning have increased social inequalities, but also brought new publics and resources to the city. The influx of Jewish gentrifiers changed the delicate balance between the diverse local communities, Palestinian and Jewish alike. While these processes are sometimes perceived by Palestinians as a Jewish colonial invasion or an orchestrated economic transfer, they also produce new scopes of agency for the creative class and social activists. Consequently, social groups that relocate to Jaffa, from liberal to radical gentrifiers, whether they are Jewish or Palestinian, use the city as a creative platform for advancing new cultural and political agendas. Our story takes place in a hidden alley in the area known as Old Jaffa. the Analulu, a locally and globally iconic bar owned by a Jewish couple sensitive to the political implications of opening a bar in such a contested and intensely gentrified area. The bar promotes an alternative cultural agenda that reaches out to a hip Palestinian crowd, as well as Mizrahi Jews and other cultural and gender minorities. The interior is filled with Orientalist image, used both as a means of mimicking and as a means of self-mocking, and a self-mocking collage of the common Israeli view of Jaffa as an exotic and conservative place. July 30th, 2015 was a special day at the Analulu Bar. It was the first time that Tamer Nafar, the leader of DAM, the first Palestinian rapper and godfather of Palestinian hip-hop, played a DJ set. The eclectic playlist ranged from early 90s American hip-hop through French rap, pop classics, Arabic hits, and up to the Israeli Balkan beatbox. It was a somewhat challenging set to the crowd that was expecting a Palestinian performance. It was ultimately received well and cheerfully. Only the Palestinian barman mumbles,
"This music is rubbish."
Suddenly, the smoky dancing floor freezes as everybody realizes it's the Israeli national anthem playing. The crowd is immediately split between Palestinian clubbers and Israeli dancers. The Palestinians reacted with restrained fury, while Israelis stand awkwardly erect like schoolchildren at a formal ceremony. The confusion can be felt. Soon enough, the uncomfortable silence turns into a burst of laughter and becomes a collective catharsis. The mixed crowd now dances to the rhythm of the Israeli anthem. The bar owners, Niv Gal and Ilana Bronstein, are amused. Gal later describes the scene as a performance of organized rage. The party is celebrated as a great success.
Merav, the scene you describe at the beginning of the article is visceral and brings so many aspects to the front. What does it represent in terms of social tension and, you know, the whole situation in Jaffa in 2015?
Actually, in order to understand 2015, I think we should go back to 2014. Which was a very tense period of time, the summer of 2014. There was a vast military operation, or war, if you would like, in the Gaza Strip, and rockets were being fired from Gaza to Israel. So a real kind of war situation. And these were very intensive and emotional times throughout the country, and especially in mixed cities, where the ethnic, national, and political tensions were enhanced to the point that they were tangible in the space. And of course, it was also a very hard time at the Analulu Bar. But in a way, I also feel it showcased the place's greatness, being able to contain these tensions, to still be a home for political discussions, for different communities, and for joint imagination, even in these times, and also for partying, which still took place. Now, the summer of 2015 represents a slightly quieter period politically, and allowed a short time for more playfully engaging with these questions of politics and identity and shared living and shared imagination. This didn't last for long because another traumatic wave of violence started shortly after, in September 2015, which also took place physically also in Jaffa. But at the same time, so in 2015, gentrification in Jaffa was ever more present, with new luxurious projects erected or planned, and an unprecedented rise in rent costs, which pushed the local community out, of course, Jewish and Arabic. Nevertheless, most of the incomers or gentrifiers were, and still to this day are, Jewish. So it added another divide and conflict between locals and newcomers, which added another very tangible layer to the already existing national and ethnic divides in the city. Moreover, if tense and violent periods of times before used to halt gentrification processes in Jaffa and kind of deter Jewish gentrifiers from moving to the city, so stop the processes for a short while or pause them, it seemed like around that time Jaffa reached a tipping point and tense political period did not affect the real estate market anymore. So gentrification just moved on. And in this urban context, and as opposed to places that were opened in Jaffa around the same time as the Honolulu positioned itself in the, at the forefront of anti-gentrification struggles by offering a bi-national space of pleasure, encounter, and engagement. But at the same time, it was taking part in the, at the very process it opposed so of gentrification, really, by being also a home for gentrifiers, Jewish and Palestinians.
What would you say was ultimately so special about the interactions concretely that happened in Honolulu?
So as I mentioned before, I think the thing that made Honolulu so special is that it was open and welcoming to all identities without shying away from conflicts and the surreality outside of the bar. So in our paper, we focus on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and how the Honolulu brought together Palestinians and Israeli Jews. But it was also a safe haven for different queer communities and other marginal groups as asylum seekers in Israel and others. And when they thought about the podcast, I got reminded of the quote from one of the Honolulu bar's regulars, who referred to the place as her utopian home and then her living room, an extension of her house and so. But then she also added, it is not solely an amazing and utopian space, but it's a space that surfaces conflicts and issues in a way that I can deal with. So I think that is really what the Lulu did. I'm trying to summarize it into two main points. I would say that it allowed a meeting point between communities that just don't have where to meet or just don't have meetings. It initiated a conversation on conflicts between equals. So it really changed the power relations. And it managed to keep a playful and political environment that allowed tackling political conflict in a productive way. So not, again, being serious to death, but kind of working through it together.
Interesting. Just to mention, I think it's also maybe showing how like the private is also very political in a sense, right?
It's always true.
Right. So touching upon the theme of positionality, why did you and Daniel choose to research this place?
So Daniel, as I said, was born and raised in Jaffa, and he's a real expert on urban binationalism in Israel and Palestine, and he's still very involved in the city life, both as an academic, but also just as a true Jaffa born and raised. And shortly after we started this, Richard, I moved to Jaffa, so I became a gentrifier. And then Honolulu became a big part of my social life, for all the reasons I already elaborated on, and I think all of you us also got the hang of the place. In this regard, part of the ethnographic observations were participatory ones. So basically, I went to a party and researched. And I think that if we take the researcher hats off for a second, that for me, it was just this incredible thing going on in Jaffa, in my own life. And in my friend's life, in our binational community. I just wanted to understand what is it exactly? What is the thing that's going on there? Both for myself, but also in order to understand if it could extend beyond this particular place and time and maybe also serve some kind of a way. So, of course, to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but maybe also to other conflicts and other urban conflicts as well.
I'm sorry that I'm going to do a comparison with Berlin one more time. But Berlin is, you know, widely known for its party scene. And I think here, partying is usually associated, you know, as said before, with escapism, you know, this attitude of, you know, I had a rough week, I need to get away from it all and just, I don't know, dance my sorrows away. But in your paper, you describe a different quality of the parties in Analulu, and you call this that there is a political eros that is kind of rising there. Can you elaborate on this?
So this is really the interesting thing, I think, about the Lulu and what we try to understand. What makes the parties in the Analulu something a bit different? What was the added value, if you wish? And Yalsagi Bizawi, one of the house DJs at the Lulu that we also quoted in the paper and interviewed, an amazing DJ and man. So he addressed this part, the parties at the Analulu as a demonstration or as a protest and as a political participation in itself. And as you mentioned, parties are often seen as escapism, as a hedonistic way to forget about the real world outside, about one's problems, and certainly about politics, I would say. Now, this was also part of the Analulu. And for some, especially one-time comers, tourists many times, the Analulu was maybe just another party with some cool Arab and Oriental music. So it's not that it didn't have this part of nightlife as well. But I think the unique setting of the Analulu in gentrifying binational Jaffa and that mixture of people did not allow the outside world, so the political, the urban and social problems, to be left outside the door. They poured in because the encounters just made them very visible. And this is what we termed political eros. So this kind of collective effervescence that caused by the mere contact with the political other. This encounter is charged with anxious excitement, simultaneous attraction and distance, and a sense of thrilling uncertainty, which is part of the creeping gentrifying of the city. Political eros was what drew a lot of the people to the Analulu. Through this, a community was built based on a principal political partnership of equals. So not ignoring what was going out outside the doors of the bar, but bringing it in and engaging with it, but in creative ways and also in fun ways.
So you also talk about this bringing out a new form of hipsterism, the so-called political hipster. How is it different with the hipster type we commonly think about, as in the person in his lumberjacket shirt and fancy moustache and dressed in cool clothes found at the secondhand shop, which is a very male painted picture of the hipster as well.
What's the female hipster?
So it's true. We mostly discussed the urban setting so far, but there's another important component to what made the Analulu what it became, and that is dialectically both a product of the Analulu space, but also an urban agent that defined the place within. And this is the social type that we call the political hipster. And I think this is an important contribution of this article, being able to identify this elusive type that is easy to disregard as yet another hipster. So aesthetically and culturally, I would say the political hipster is very similar to the regular hipster. As you mentioned, vintage clothes, beards, indie music, and so on. We give a more detailed explanation and definitions in the paper, but in short, there are a couple of key elements to discern the political hipster from a typical one. So firstly, the political hipster replaces this ironic attitude with a more confrontational engagement, basically. The typical hipster protests mass consumerism by changing her consumerist preferences, while the political hipster actively struggles against injustices and strives to change political and social power structures. In such, the political hipster regards herself as a political activist, really. Her activism oscillates between active participation in distinct political spheres, such as demonstrations and rallies and so on, to suggestively viewing a dance party as a subversive political event, as we discussed. Now, unlike the typical hipster, who is mostly attuned to global affairs and regards himself as a cosmopolitan, the political hipster represents a translocalist approach and reacts to concurrent events in her immediate surroundings. The political hipster cares and cares a lot about what's going on around her, and she reacts and acts, sometimes in creative ways. A big part of our interest in the place was to understand this special social and urban type that manages to transform everything that they take part into a political statement. In the paper, we outlined the political hipster that was formed in the Analulu, revolving three symbolic types, so Palestinian, Levantine and Mizrahi, which again, you would need to read the paper for, because this really delves into kind of the Israeli society. I would argue that we can find this type in different places, and this is what we defined as the hipster paradox. The hipster paradox is the hipster trying to fit in by standing out. And we think that local components can sometimes really give this answer. So it's not about indie music or ragged clothes, but it's about finding kind of the local features that makes you stand out and being politically engaged.
Do you think, we're starting 2022. Do you still find the political hipster nowadays? How do you look at this paper, you know, a couple of years after?
So it's true that Diana Lulu was closed in 2019, but papers take a long time to get written and published. So it's not, the reflection is not that long ago. I think that part of what we're trying to ask in the paper, and I'm still asking myself, is whether the political hipster has presence and existence without the Diana Lulu. And I would argue that it does. And I think that if we look at the Israeli landscape, so we had a big protest against the government during basically 1920, which did end at the end in so Bibi being replaced and stuff. One of my key observations of that demonstration was really you could see that the people who led it from the younger generation, you had like the older generation, were political hipsters. That has to do also with COVID and people being at home. A lot of creative professionals that stayed at home and became very engaged. If you look at the footage from this, I think it would be very apparent that these are political hipsters. I do think it political hipsters are out there. I think they are defined differently in different locales, because also the things they react to are different. And in this regard, I think that the more the global the city is, maybe it's harder to identify these people as so kind of localist political hipsters, because the things they address, and I would very carefully, without researching, say this about Berlin, for instance, because I think what you would see is mostly really reactions to globalization, to mass consumerism, so in the urban context to gentrification, which are very important things, of course, but they are global. In this regard, they remain cosmopolitan, they remain on the global layer. While in places that have more urgent, I would call it maybe local problems, you would see more reactions to local state of affairs, but it doesn't mean it doesn't happen in Berlin. You see, you have this revolving asylum seekers, and I think that during the big migration or refugee influx, you did have these kind of little examples for this.
I don't know if it's actually termed like this, but I think if we talk like the normal, if we can say hipster, they probably have a kind of very well-established socioeconomic status. Can we generally say they have like equal, like general socioeconomic status, or is that something which transcends?
I should limit my response to the research I did, which is a very specific one about the political hipster, which is a term we also came up with, so we could decide what it is. Yeah. About the political hipster in Jaffa in a specific context. And in this regard, we really focus not on the class framework, but on the ethnical or national one. But in our research, what we see is and what you can say is that the political hipster is the gentrifier. So it would, in 95%, if not 99% of the cases, would be people that came outside of Jaffa, and as such are gentrifiers or gentrifiers in potential, which means there is also a class dimension to this. But in the Israeli and Jaffine context of the thing, it doesn't have to be about class, or again, it can be about ethnicity. So of course, we can talk about symbolic capital, social capital, and so on, which of course are part of being a Jew in Israel. Or if we do talk about the Palestinian political hipsters, a lot of them come from the north, for instance. So yeah, they do have also, there is a class dimension. Usually they will be wealthier than the local Jaffa community. But I would be reluctant to say this is the biggest a big component of this.
Are there any last key findings that you would like to share with us?
So I've talked so much already, but maybe shortly before we end, it is important to also mention those who did not take part in the Lulu parties, because we described it as a fantastic and magical thing. But of course, there were rejections and people who did not like it. So from within, as we discussed, the bar was formed and cherished by the political hipsters. And also a lot of one-time comers, whether it's tourists or people that came to see kind of this exotic thing. But another way of understanding and defining the place is from without, so through the people who avoided the space. And these are the Tel Aviv bourgeoisie, low socioeconomic Jaffa Jews, and some Jaffa Arab women who feared for their reputation by coming to a place that serves alcohol and coming to a place that is very gender liberal. And all of these people would prefer actually mainstream cultural venues and preferably not mixed one. The crowds that avoided the Analulu stress out the point that, much like other places that were open in Jaffa during the same time, the Analulu bar was enabled by gentrification processes and the urban setting allowed it in a specific point in time. These same processes were the reason the place closed down in 2019 after endless legal fights with the neighbors and planning authorities. You can say gentrification won at the end.
Noise complaints as a universal killer of culture.
Was it just a place for parties, actually? Because you said there was also political discussions, but it, like, in the sense of parties, or did other formats basically happen within the space?
It's very hard to summarize research of 5 years, but also a place that is so close to your heart into such a short format, basically. Yeah. But in the Analulu, you had, so it was open 7 days a week, maybe 6 days a week at some point. You had the Arab music parties. You had also different parties. There was, just from the top of my head, there were really bizarre things like computer games music parties. That's weird. It's not fun to listen for a long time.
How do you dance to it?
Nights like that was named Queer Here. There were also Turkish parties, which in the Israeli, it's funny because that's, I think, something really imported from Berlin, because Turkish music is not a big thing in Israel, but in the Lulu, it had place. Another strength of the Analulu was being a place for the Palestinian queer community, which is a marginal community two times, so mm-hmm. intersectionality and so on. And this is just, again, I'm being reminded of quotes from people that we did in the research, but I remember one of the guys, a Palestinian gay guy, that saw the Lulu really as his home, and he said, maybe I'm misquoting, but this is where I feel at home. I can wear both of my identities, gay and Palestinian, here, and without a problem. Mm-hmm. So he would. He had very good Hebrew. You could not tell he's Palestinian. He didn't have an accent or so. So if he would walk in Tel Aviv, he could walk as this gay guy. And if he would walk in Palestinian areas, he could be the Palestinian guys. But being a gay Palestinian, that was always an issue. And there, that was a place where he could be both and be proud of being both and being accepted as being both.
Thank you very much, Merav. We hope you had a good time with us.
Yeah, I found it very interesting to see how this night space is such a vibrant place for political action, actually.
Thanks for the invitation. I had a really good time and I'm curious to hear how this will sound like.
Yeah, we are curious as well.